You're tuned in to People's Tribune Radio. I'm Kenny Shook.
And so this new world coming upon us objectively offers hope and promise and possibility. We just got the wrong people in charge. The right things are happening, but the wrong people are driving the car.
People's Tribune Radio is brought to you by the League of Revolutionaries for a New America, who also publishes the newspaper People's Tribune and the magazine Tribuno del Pueblo. Ordering and contact information will be provided at the end of the show. Today we have a special show about a professor and a book. The professor from the University of Illinois, Dr. Bill Watkins. The book, Black Protest Thought and Education. I was able to sit down with Dr. Watkins in Chicago before the spring 2005 release of Black Protest Thought and Education. First, we should find out a little bit about your background. Now, it's my understanding you grew up in Watts, California. That's a pretty tough neighborhood. What was it like growing up, and how did you become an academic?
Well, actually, I was born in Harlem, so Watts was a piece of cake after Harlem. But yeah, L.A. was tough, and everyone knows the story. I don't need to recap it. I don't know. I went to school. The 1960s was a period of intense protests, both civil rights protests and anti-war protests. For some good reason, I got attracted to both of those struggles, especially as they came together. And it was the movement, I think, that helped catapult me into academia, because I began to seek out answers to questions of poverty and racism and social justice, and just took to the study of the social sciences, looking for those answers.
What kind of work got you to where you're at now? Where are you teaching at today, too?
Well, I'm teaching right now at the University of Illinois at Chicago, but it's been a long journey. I, of course, had to go through the graduate school process, and primarily I'm an academic, but my roots are in community work. I was involved in many of the struggles in L.A. in the 60s and 70s. I guess you could say I'm an academic of a new type.
What kind of community work are you involved with?
Most of the community work I was involved in was around urban renewal, at least initially, where parts of L.A. were designated for regentrification and poor people were going to lose their property and be scattered about. And as I look back on that now, the friends and I who were involved in some of these struggles, we were really ahead of our time. Now we see the regentrification movement everywhere. And we see the creation of Bantustans in many of America's big cities where people of color are being scattered and sent to the outlying areas, to the hinterlands, and the middle class is being drawn back into the city. So the displacement that we were concerned about 35 years ago is now going full force in effect.
Yeah, I think we even see that here in Chicago. I don't want to get off too much of the subject, but where do people go after this gentrification process takes place? You say the hinterlands, but I think a lot of people are trying to put that into perspective.
Yeah, that's the question we all want to know. Right here, Chicago, in many ways, provides an exemplar for the rest of the country, like in public schooling, and also in the destruction of the housing projects. We had here what was called the State Street Corridor, where approximately 475,000 people lived in housing projects. I believe the largest housing projects in the world. And within the last 4 to 5 years, those projects have all disappeared. And I live right here, and I drive by them every day, and even I can't believe how rapidly those projects came down. And the question I have is, where are all the people? And apparently they've been scattered to the suburbs, they've been scattered through the Section 8 program into communities throughout the city. So it's, you know, the city's experimenting. They don't quite know what they're doing. We do know that real estate speculation has grown in importance in America's urban landscape. And we see it with the universities, with the big corporations. So this real estate speculation, along with the other speculation that we see taking place among the financial sectors, is restructuring our society right in front of our very eyes.
To kind of get back on track, your main fight, the one that you talk about the most, seems to be education. Can you talk a little bit about what your current struggle is? And
sure. I ended up quite by accident as a teacher, teaching high school in those very same housing projects that I talked about. And I taught for 10 years, and I became smitten after about the first 5 minutes of teaching and working with so-called underprivileged, poor working class folks. For me, I mean, the big attraction, I could talk forever about education and teaching, but it's about ideas. And ideas are powerful things. And ideas give rise to hope and to promise and vision. And I think it was Karl Marx that said, ideas, when gripped by the masses, can become a material force. And so in teaching right away, I saw the power of ideas. And I can understand why education is so important, both to working class folks, the propertyless, and at the same time, it's important to the ruling class, because education can either liberate or control. And so this battle of ideas, that's a major part of the class struggle, is where I've devoted the last 20 years of my life.
Well, in this latest anthology that you have, Black Protest Thought and Education, you seem to target education throughout all the different ideologies that were going on, mostly around the protest area. You want to talk about that a little bit?
Sure, I want to talk about that a lot. You just have to cut me off. It has come to my attention over the years that education has been central to public policy. Education has been central to the shaping of America. Education has been central to the class struggle, to the struggle of people of color. Education transcends all areas of our society for the aforementioned reasons, because of its power and because of what it does. So in this latest piece, what I'm attempting to do is survey the critique of public education in the last 100 years, coming from different avenues of Black protests. And there have been many avenues, from Black feminist movement, the Black nationalist movement, the critical race theorists, the Black separatists, the Black Marxists, on and on. And I'm trying to get a sampling from these different movements and some understanding of their take on education, their critique. So I've called together some scholars and some activists and people who have distinguished themselves in particular fields of study, and asked them to contribute essays. This is something that's not frequently done in the field of education. This could be a groundbreaking book. So we'll see. But that's kind of an introduction.
And what are you finding with some of the essays that are coming in?
Well, we're finding, again, that education has been central and near and dear to the heart of the protest movement in every single manifestation. And we're finding that people throughout, and that goes for people of color, it goes for white working class people, have all looked to education for a better life, for understanding, for enlightenment. And we see at the same time the consistent efforts of the ruling class to control ideas, to ration education, deny education. So we're looking at the manifestations of the demand-denial dialectic. It's interesting reading. I'm faced with the questionable task of editing things in my book that I don't agree with. But it's interesting. Some of the authors come from a point of view that I don't support, but their voices are going to be heard in this particular work.
I just want to remind people you're tuned into People's Tribune Radio. We're speaking with Dr. Bill Watkins from the University of Illinois. You mentioned a little bit about demand, denial, dialectic, and I was wondering if you could maybe explain that for us.
Yeah, I mean, it seems to me that the greatest demand of the property-less folks and the working classes and the lower classes from slavery on up to the present day has been for education, for an understanding of the world that surrounds us. And people want to be able to appreciate and make sense of the world, because the world often seems senseless. And we have wars, and we have Holocaust, and we have massacres, and we have all sorts of horrific things. So there seems to me to be a consistent demand on the part of people. Going back to slavery, I mean, throughout my work, I've been just absolutely amazed at how the slaves and illiterate folks, the demand for education was always a part of their agenda. And the slaves worked extremely hard to gain some education. All we do read the autobiography of Frederick Douglass and other slaves who, at peril of their lives, tried to study and tried to understand the world. And the other side of the dialectic is the attempt to control ideas on the part of the ruling elite and the vested interests, who only support ideas that support their rule. For them, censorship is the key, and the brokering, what I call in my work, the brokering of ideas by the ruling class, the shaping of ideas to support oppression and subservience and to justify and apologize for class society and poverty and racism. And so hence we have a tug of war that's lasted for three centuries and is becoming even more intense, because the battle for justice is in part a battle for education, in large part.
You talk a lot about classes, working class, ruling class. Could you maybe describe a little bit this division?
Yeah. By ruling class, I mean those folks that are invested in property and wealth and running the country, shaping society to their liking, engineering society, building empires, and those who own factories, mines, mills, banks, computer companies, et cetera, et cetera. And I include the media, the fourth branch of government, in with the ruling class. And by working classes, I'm talking about the people who are propertyless, oppressed, who work for a living. So it's the age-old contradiction between those who work and don't own and those who own and don't work.
Who are some of the other writers that are included in this anthology?
Professor Sidney Lamell from California, the brilliant African historian, has written just a wonderful chapter that I think introduces the entire book. His chapter will open the book. I have professors of education. Joy Williamson at Stanford University has written a chapter on the Black Panther Party and their critique of public education. And as everyone knows, or everyone may know, education was central to the Panther Party's program and to their organizing activities. And Huey P. Newton and Bobby Seale and all these guys, they met in community college seeking education. And many, if not most of them, have been lifelong learners and students. Other professors, Dr. Beverly Gordon at Ohio State University has written a chapter on cultural nationalism and that critique of education. Dr. Haroon Kareem at Brooklyn College has written a chapter looking at the Black struggle and its historic critique of public education. Professor Annette Henry from the University of Illinois has written a chapter on black feminism and education. Dr. David Stovall from the University of Illinois has written a chapter looking at critical race theory and its examination of education. Dr. Dion Danz, also from the University of Illinois, has written a chapter looking at the student protest movement in the 1960s and their critique of public education. So we see the critique of public education coming from many quarters. And, of course, my chapter looks at the critique of public education from the standpoint of black Marxists in the 20th century. So we have, I think, a rounded set of essays.
You try to encapsulate a lot of groups within this anthology. Is there any ideologies that you kind of wanted to put in the book but couldn't find somebody to write on the topic?
No, we pretty much have most of the areas covered. We did some collapsing and consolidating, and I really wanted the Marxian critique, which has never been written about, at least a black Marxian critique. So this is some groundbreaking work, and it has not been easy research, and the readers will immediately see that we're making a call for a further examination. So in many ways, this is an opening volley.
And what was it like trying to put together this piece?
My own piece. It's been difficult because the research is not cohesive. There's not a lot of documentation. We have many records of trade unionists who were teacher trade unionists who were revolutionaries and teachers. And we're trying to gather their documents. They're scattered about the country and not in any organized fashion. And so this work is, at least academically, it's in an embryonic stage. But there is other work developing around the country. Daniel Perlstein at Berkeley has a new book coming out on protests in general and education. Of course, Charles Payne's wonderful book, Charles Payne at Duke, my good friend, his book on the freedom schools in Mississippi is excellent work. Clarence Taylor from Florida has good stuff coming out. Martha Biondi at Northwestern University. A lot of interesting books developing about protests and protest thought and those dynamic issues which have fueled the protest movement.
How does this work tie to some of your previous works?
Well, for the last 20 years, I've been writing about education. And so while we have a body of thought on protest movements, we have very little on education protest. This work, I believe, links what I've been doing in the past with some other disciplines and some other areas. And I hope it's going to open up a new genre because my work is primarily in the field of education. And I want to contribute to the radical discourses in education. And I'm part of, I think, the radical, whatever you want to call us, Young Turks. I'm part of that thing. And so I hope that we're moving in a positive direction. Most of all, I hope that we're making some sense to people. And most importantly, I hope that we can serve as an organizing force, because education is now central to even traditional politics now. Our president claims he wants to be the education president. Every governor wants to be the education governor. Every mayor wants to be the education mayor. So education is on the front burner of everyone's agenda. And so I'm hoping that this discourse that we're working with will make some sense and also provide a pole from which people can break away from the nonsense and the rubbish that they're hearing coming from these mayors and governors.
This is People's Tribune Radio. We are speaking with Dr. Bill Watkins about the book Black Protest Thought and Education. You mentioned radical and revolutionary in there, and you talked about your piece on Black Marxism. What would you say to folks who, especially in academia, who consider Marxism dead?
There's plenty of them. Well, you know, that's an issue I've been dealing with for a long time. And everyone can see now that even though they tried to bury Marx, the contradictions of the capitalist system and of the world that we live in, and the contradictions of a globalized economy, refuse to let Marxism die, despite the fact that everyone has already delivered their obituary and has thrown a shovel full of dirt onto the coffin of Marxism. It continues to rise, not because of anything mystical or magical, but because it represents the objective realities of a class-structured world and society. And so the contradictions that Marx described 150 years ago are even sharper today, as the wealth of the world is consolidated in the hands of a very few people. And the pyramiding, not only of our society, but of every society, and in fact, of the whole world. So Marx won't die, despite attempts to kill it. The oppression and suffering of masses of people throughout the world is increasing, and the misery index is increasing, and pauperization is increasing in our country and throughout the world. So, sorry if you have pronounced Marx dead. I apologize. Feel bad for you, but he's coming back bigger than ever.
You mentioned quite a bit of stuff in there, like a good vision where people aren't suffering and a world where probably everyone would be educated. It's a central part of your studies and what you look at. How do you envision this world? What do you see in a world where this can take place?
That's a great question. I'm glad you asked, because with the technological revolution in the world today, well, let me back up a step. I think utopians and dreamers and philosophers have always painted a picture, a futuristic picture of the world where people were not bound to labor. And in this world, people could be free to be philosophers, connoisseurs of art, connoisseurs of science, where the civil side of human nature could assert itself over the more competitive and other side that sort of capitalism draws upon. So as an educator, I'm absolutely tantalized by the notion of human beings being freed from the yoke of labor so that they can pursue this culture, if you will. And I don't want to sound European in any sense, but labor has been an obstacle and a hindrance to the development of humanity. And so this new world that is coming upon us objectively offers hope and promise and possibility. We just got the wrong people in charge. But the right things are happening, but the wrong people are driving the car. So we just need to make a few little changes here and there. And the possibilities for, you know, again, I'm not a utopian, but the possibilities for a bountiful life and a life where people can truly self-actualize is over the horizon.
Do you have any last words about the book?
As the protest against capital and reaction and empire and war and these horrible people who are running our country and running the world, as the protest against their rule intensifies, works like mine and other works of that genre, I think, are going to take on new meaning because they cut through some of the rhetoric and some of the ideological madness of traditional scholarship. So we're hopeful. We hope that it can serve as a tool not only to clarify, but to organize people, and people can come together in protest.
Thanks for sitting down with People's Tribune Radio.
All right. Always my pleasure.
We're almost through with this edition of People's Tribune Radio. We've already heard from Dr. Bill Watkins about the spring 2005 release of the book he edited titled Black Protest, Thought, and Education. But now we're going to bring you a piece from the March 2005 People's Tribune newspaper's Vision column, where retired Georgia school teacher Gloria Slaughter writes about education in a cooperative society. Correspondent Tony Zaragoza and I sat down for a conversational reading using the column. So I was thinking education in a cooperative society would enable every student to reach his or her academic potential.
Since education in a new society would not focus on occupations for profit,
but on fulfilling the needs and wants of the students,
there would be no need for two tracks.
You mean like college prep?
And vocational.
All students would be educated with lifelong skills.
The arts would be placed as a priority,
so that those students who wanted to excel in writing, music, visual arts, and drama would be able to do so.
Physical education and nutrition would be part of the curriculum so that the mind and body would reach the optimum.
There'd be enough teachers and staff to help each student learn.
We would graduate students who could read and write.
There'd even be enough staff to offer tutoring to those who are having problems or who have disabilities.
And even tutoring one-on-one.
We'd even protect students from dropping out of school.
Students would pace themselves in their coursework, so we wouldn't necessarily have to continue the concept of grades.
You mean like first grade, second grade?
Yeah, and testing would only be used to demonstrate that students had adequate knowledge to go into a certain field.
The curriculum would be interesting and provide a real history of the indigenous people.
Students would learn in a variety of ways.
Students teaching each other.
Through technology.
Role-playing.
Discipline-based.
Arts education.
And new methods we haven't even come up with yet.
The curriculum would encompass studies of other lands, nationalities, and religions, and bring about an understanding of all humanity.
Parents would be able to volunteer in schools.
Hey, maybe they'd even be able to take a day off work during the month and have their transportation provided.
The schools would be open during the evenings and weekends so the community could use the facilities.
Like maybe for adult lessons, sports events, computer training, tutoring. How about even swimming lessons, man? Possibilities are endless.
New school buildings would be built and others would be renovated.
That'd be a great job program since workers would be needed to build these schools.
And staff them too.
In a new society, there'd be more leisure time because machines would produce the necessities without human labor.
Work would be rewarding because each person in society would be productive, building a better future for all humanity.
You mean instead of building the military for war and devastation?
Yeah, college education would be free.
Vocational schools would be free.
There'd be a great school for every child and adult.
We have the technology in the world to provide abundance to all.
If the economic system is not based on private property.
The move towards a jobless society is occurring with the invention of the robot.
We must create a world where our educational institutions are not operated for profit.
Not operated only for the means of providing skills for a few people to work in corporations.
But for the benefit of all humanity.
We have to educate the whole person.
A cooperative society would guarantee this.
Thanks for tuning in to People's Tribune Radio. PT Radio is brought to you by the League of Revolutionaries for a New America. The League advocates for a cooperative society with distribution based on need so everyone can have a proper quality of life with more than adequate education at the forefront. If you would like to find out more about the League, our other print and media resources, or our speakers, please give us a call at 1-800-691-6888. That number once again is 1-800-691-6888. Also, visit us on the web at www.lrna.org. Once again, I'm Kenny Shook. Thanks for tuning in, and please join us next time for People's Tribune Radio.